For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the WGTD morning show comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they have not lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, and mugs. jackandrea.com. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I am really excited that we can have back on the program via Zoom Nan Calvert for her monthly visit to the morning show. And she has scheduled something of a reunion on today's program. We're going to be reconnecting with one of the country's most renowned authorities and experts when it comes to one of the most amazing creatures in the wild, the dragonfly, and its close relative, the damselfly. And we had Mabel Garrison on the morning show. Marla Garrison, not too long ago. Nan, tell us what prompted you to want to issue this re-invitation.
Well, you know, a lot of us have the opportunity to spend a bit more time outside, which is the perfect place to social distance. And what a lot of us have been noticing is seemingly an abundance of dragonflies and damselflies and jewel wings. It's really been spectacular. So I thought it would be a perfect time to have Marla come back on and talk to us about these just marvelous beings that we share our world with. They're truly miraculous in every way. And, you know, I'm jealous of the people who get such great close-up photos of them. Their wings are gorgeous, and you know, their flight capabilities are just otherworldly. And now is a great time to get out there and watch them.
Very good. So for all those reasons and more, we're happy to have Marla Garrison back on the morning show. She is a biology instructor at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois, the author of Damselflies of Chicagoland. She is a former member of the executive board of the Dragonfly Society of the Americas, and she has done work with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as an investigator surrounding a particular dragonfly that was endangered. And so her interest in dragonflies and damselflies is ranges far afield, and her credentials are impressive. And we really appreciate her making time in her schedule to be part of the morning show today. Marla Garrison, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. And Nan, it is a pleasure to be here once again.
Well, thank you. I'm so glad you were able to do this.
So let's begin, Marla Garrison, by finding out a little bit about your general interests, which obviously have a lot to do with the natural world and its creatures. And then explain how your primary focus of interest became the dragonfly and the damselfly.
Well, I actually am a molecular microbiologist by education. And so I came the back door into the natural history angle. I have always loved everything in natural history. And it's only after you go through your whole educational system and you realize, oh, I wish I had gone another route. So I think that's where I was. I realized that, you know, I love working in the lab. It's wonderful to be in science, but I really prefer being outdoors, and I really prefer discovering and studying the taxonomy, the phylogeny of the living organisms on the planet Earth. And so I was bemoaning my fate in molecular biology, and I was working down at the Nature Museum with Doug Tarin, doing some molecular work on microsatellite markers of all things in butterflies. And I was introduced to dragonflies at that time, and that was maybe 18 years or so ago. And in the course of speaking to a gentleman down there at the Nature Museum, I realized that they are amazing creatures, and I want to know more. So I left the lab and I walked outdoors and I started classifying dragonflies, and I got involved with several organizations, one of which is the Wisconsin Odonata Survey and the Wisconsin Dragonfly Society. And Wisconsin is really at the forefront of citizen based monitoring when it comes to dragonflies. They really set the bar for the entire nation. Wow. And it's due to two gentlemen, Robert Dubois, Bob Dubois, and William Smith, or Bill Smith. They are both Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource scientists. And in the late 90s, they saw a need for studying and learning more about the dragonflies that are present in the state of Wisconsin. But two men and a boat cannot survey every aquatic habitat or wetland in the state efficiently. So they actually developed the Wisconsin Odonata Survey, and that Odonata are dragonflies and damselflies. That's the insect order, Odonata. And it means toothed ones, by the way, because they are quite carnivorous in both their aquatic and their terrestrial state. But they started that survey in 2002 or so. And by 2012, they had broadened it into the Wisconsin Dragonfly Society. And from there, it has really flourished in the state. And they have, just through that citizen science program, accumulated over 30,000 records of dragonflies in the state, added many more to the list. There's some 166 or so dragonflies and damselfly species in the state of Wisconsin, and there's another five or so potential species. So Bob Dubois was one of the reasons I got into studying dragonflies to deeper level.
Wow. So you've already mentioned the fact that if you want to see dragonflies, Wisconsin is a great place to be, and not just if you're on Nan's farm, but that apparently they are.
Well, you can see quite a few there.
Yeah, but so apparently they are quite numerous here in the state of Wisconsin and in the upper Midwest. Give us maybe an overview of where the dragonfly tends to live. I suspect that it lives just about all over the planet. Is this where they are mostly found, or is their presence fairly evenly distributed amongst the various continents?
They are found on every continent except Antarctica. And so they are ubiquitous in that regard, but where you mostly find them is near wetlands or aquatic habitats, freshwater generally, although there are a few species that can survive in more saline environments. Most of all the rest require fresh water for breeding. And one thing, we're so used to seeing them in the air, but they are aquatic insects. So they spend the majority of their life underwater as what we call nymphs or naiads. And they can live after a female deposits her eggs or oviposits in a specific aquatic habitat, whether it's a river, a stream, an ephemeral pool, a marsh, a ditch along the roadside, or even a swimming pool in a backyard. The eggs hatch, and they go through multiple instars or growth stages, much like a caterpillar in the butterfly life cycle. And they molt, they get larger and larger until eventually they leave the water and they emerge as an adult. So that can take anywhere from a couple of months in some damselfly species to 5 or 7 years in the case of the Heinz Emerald dragonfly, which is the only endangered dragonfly in the lower 48. So they are going to be anywhere where there is water. I've even dip netted dragonfly nymphs out of tire ruts in the tropical rainforests.
Wow.
Their logging truck has gone through and it rained, and within a couple of days you've got nymphs in those pools.
Wow. So dragonflies live all over the planet, maybe not in the harshest of deserts, but in just about every other environment where there is water. It also seems like the dragonfly is something that has been with us a long time, or at least creatures like the dragonfly. A lot of times when we see pictorial representations of what the ancient earth looked like, when there were other creatures there that are no longer with us, many times we see creatures that look like huge dragonflies pictured in such scenes. Just how far back can we trace either the dragonfly or creatures very similar to it?
There is a sister group of ancient insects, flying insects, called the griffinflies. And I believe that's what you're talking about in the fossil record. And they go back to about 325 million years ago.
Wow.
So they're in the Pennsylvanian era, and they are not era, but they actually had wingspans of 2.5 feet or so, about 27 centimeters. They were huge.
Wow.
So if you imagine those cycad forests of the Carboniferous period, and the ferns and the mosses. They were the top predators at that time, and they must have flown like pterodactyls around. If I had a time machine, I'd be there. So they did die out. They go through, I believe, the Permian. When we had one of the major extinctions on Earth, of the five major extinctions, the Triaso-Permian extinction wiped out about 70% of the insects on Earth. And it's the only main extinction event that wiped out a large portion of insects. However, the ancestors to dragonflies made it through. And by the Cretaceous period, we see modern dragonflies show up, and they radiate out through the Jurassic. And in other words, if you look back about 65 million years ago, and you were walking around the forest back then, you would actually see modern families of dragonflies flying, and you'd be able to identify them. This is a clubtail. This is a skimmer. You know, this is a cruiser. They haven't. I have a friend, Ken Tennyson, who is the foremost expert on dragonflies in the United States, and he's up there in the top five in the world. He lives in Wisconsin. And Ken has just finished his tome called Dragonfly Nymphs of North America, 1900 hand drawings of nymphs, the dichotomous keys. The man's a genius. And he has a saying that there is no evolutionary challenge that has not been thrown at dragonflies that they have not overcome. And I don't think you can even say that of cockroaches. So I'm reminded of the scene in Jurassic Park, the movie, when the paleontologist shows that 10-year-old kid the Velociraptor claw and says, "So have a little respect." It's like, that's what I want to say about dragonflies all the time. These guys have made it through everything, and there's actually one species of dragonfly in Illinois. And it is called a petal-tailed dragonfly, the gray petal-tail. It's found in only a couple of places in central eastern Illinois. And it's not yet found in Wisconsin. But it is believed to be the oldest living, by some, including Chris Beatty, who wrote the paper on it, the oldest living species on Earth at 103 wow. million years unchanged.
Mm.
Wow, so older than horseshoe crabs then.
Yeah, so I talked to him about horseshoe crabs. I'm like, what about the horseshoe crab? That's what we always learn. That's the oldest living species on Earth. And I think Chris would tell you that he thinks it blows the horseshoe crab away. He thinks it is.
Well, good.
But I don't know. That's a debate.
Before we get into some more specifics about the dragonfly and what makes it so wondrous, I want to circle back to what prompted Nan to invite you back, Marla Garrison, namely the fact that she feels like she is seeing a lot of dragonflies these days. And I have to add that in the last 2 weeks, I have seen dragonflies, or maybe damselflies, but I think they were dragonflies, in our own yard. And I don't ever remember seeing dragonflies before, although maybe I just missed them. Although that's hard to imagine because they're so beautiful and distinctive. But are we seeing a lot of dragonflies right now compared to what we've seen recently? Or are Nan and I just imagining it?
I think that depends on where you are in the country and what the weather has been like in the last year. And we've had a very cold and wet spring. We had a very, very wet spring and summer last year. The population of dragonflies is largely tied to weather events for the adults, because a severe thunderstorm can take them out and just strip them out of the trees at night. They last as adults for 3 to 6 weeks or so, but if there's storms, it can wipe them away. If there's flooding issues and so forth, that if you have a mass emergence and waves generated by a motorboat or by whatever flooding situation, it might come up and wipe them out before they are capable of emerging and drying off. So I think weather plays a big role in how many dragonflies you see. The diversity of the dragonflies you see is another question. You may see many, many, many of the very common species, the kind that emerge out of retention ponds at the back of townhome communities. And those would be maybe more what we call the really water quality tolerant species. But I study more nymphs now than adult dragonflies, and I was dip netting this spring, and I was surprised by the sheer number of nymphs I was pulling out of the water. When they emerge, oftentimes has to do with water temperature. So it might be that right now some are emerging a little bit later than they did last year, because we did have a colder spring, and the temperature of the water didn't warm up as fast. But I know we're all concerned about insect populations diminishing. The German study that is held up, that 20-year-long study in Germany, really showed some shocking declines in a variety of different insects. I hope that doesn't happen here to dragonflies. Wisconsin is truly filled with wonderful dragonflies, and the diversity is phenomenal in some of the protected areas in Wisconsin.
For those of you just joining us, today is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to the morning show, and with her is Marla Garrison, who is one of the country's primary experts, authorities, when it comes to the dragonfly and the damselfly, its close relative. And so we're talking with her on the morning show today about these amazing creatures. So Marla Garrison, first explain to us what a creature has to possess in order for it to be classified as a dragonfly.
Well, dragonflies are insects, first of all. So they're six-legged. They have the arthropod outer skeleton of the hardened outer chitinous skeleton. They have a head, thorax, and abdomen. But dragonflies are also flying insects. So they have wings. They have, they're classified in the order Odonata for a number of primitive characteristics that they have and a number of derived characteristics that are exceptional. So when you consider an odonate, either a dragonfly or a damselfly, the first thing you note is they have very primitive mouth parts. They have four parts to their mouth. They are carnivorous. They eat loads of mosquitoes and deer fly for us. Luckily, in the north woods of Wisconsin, you always want them flying around your head up there. They take out mosquito larvae when they're in their aquatic nymph form as well. So they are constantly eating. And that has to do with a very primitive mouth structure that allows them to just macerate, grab and macerate their food. So that's one thing. As adults, they have the most remarkably long abdomen for flying insects. It's 10 segments. And when you see that really long abdomen, you wonder how on earth can this thing get off the ground? But it does, because it can carry the most massive wing load, I believe, of any animal on earth. I mean, it has the ability to lift up its wings, and this is remarkable. Its wings are each attached individually to its thorax, or to muscles in the thorax, not directly to the thorax. So if you think of a fly or a butterfly, they're newer evolutionarily speaking, and their wings are attached directly to the thorax, and then the thorax muscles move it, and that flaps their wings. But dragonflies, they have individual muscles attached to their wings, so they can move each wing independently of the other wings, which means that they can move like a helicopter, straight up, go down, they can back up, they can go forward at this, just, they can leave a stem at a remarkable speed. They can fly through the air and take out another flying insect as a prey item. And they can move at speeds upwards to 30, 35 kilometers per hour. Wow. So they can turn on a dime. They can sit down and it looks like they're falling out of the air. They have remarkable flight. They are primarily visual. So they have the most spectacular eyes of any animal species. They have in each of their very large eyes what are called 15,000 ommatidia. Those are the facets, almost like a facets on a diamond that's been cut, if you think of that. And 15,000 on each eye. And their eyes are huge. Dragonflies have eyes that almost form a 360 globe around their head. Sometimes they even touch in the middle on top. Damselflies have, they look like hammerhead sharks. They have their eyes out away on a transverse plane, and they've got this big area in the middle where there's no eyeball, but they sit on stems, so the stem is always in the way, so their eyes come out and around on the side. You cannot sneak up on a dragonfly. It sees you coming from above, below, to the side. It sees everything. But what's really cool about their vision is that they, on the top layers of their eyes, they have different photoreceptors, different color photoreceptors. They carry at least 15 different photoreceptors. You and I have 3, red, blue, and green cones. They have 15. They see colors we can't even imagine. And they see UV light. They see polarized light, so they know how deep water is and how it reflects off, gives them some information of habitat. It's incredible. And then finally, they have the most remarkable reproductive structures in males of any animal on earth. Males have 2 pair of genitalia. They have testes down by segment 8 and 9, and they release sperm from there, but then they have to curl their abdomen around to bring it up to segment 2, where they have a secondary genitalia, and they have to pump the sperm in there and get it ready before they mate with the female. And so if you've ever seen dragonflies mate, it's pretty impressive. They do what we call in wheel, and they form a circle around each other. The male grabs the female, if it's a dragonfly, behind the eyes, sometimes even poking holes in her eyes, and hangs onto her that way, and then she curls her abdomen up to his segment too. Because otherwise, how would you mate when your abdomens are 10 segments long, extremely long? You'd have to back up, you know, like construction trucks, and try and engage. Well, they can't do that. So he just grabs her by the eyes. She curls her abdomen around and engages with its secondary apparatus. And no one else on earth has that. So that's pretty spectacular.
Wow. So for instance, all these different varieties of dragonflies that you tell us are all over the world. So for instance, do all of them share what you were just describing in terms of this very uncommon structure of the reproduction system?
Yes, those are characteristics of all dragonflies and damselflies. It gets even cooler, because damselflies especially have the ability in that secondary genitalia. They have, I always liken it to a Swiss Army knife. If you look at it under the microscope, it's phenomenal. It's got so many different utensils. And one of them is basically, in damselflies, they have a spoon-like structure. and they scoop the sperm out of the female before they mate with her, before they pump their sperm in, so that they can remove that to ensure paternity. So a lot of times you'll see them in wheel, and about 90% or more of the time they're spent in wheel is just the male removing the sperm from the prior mating.
Wow, wow. Tell us more about the distinction between dragonflies and damselflies. I know from the pictures I've seen that damselflies are smaller, but otherwise at a glance, they certainly look a lot like dragonflies, but I'm sure to your expert eye, there are all kinds of distinctions that can be drawn between the two. Help us understand the relationship between dragonflies and damselflies.
Well, you're absolutely right. Damselflies are almost always much smaller. There is a helicopter, a group of helicopter damselflies in the tropical rainforest that are larger than any dragonfly on Earth in terms of length of the body. But for the most part, they're about the size of toothpicks, down, some of them down to maybe straight pins. Very, very small and very thin. They fly low in the grasses beside the water. Generally, they stay pretty close to the water. And they have, as I mentioned before, their eyes are set apart from each other on their head capsule. And so they look a bit like hammerhead sharks. They fold their wings over their back, usually when they perch. Dragonflies are much larger. They fly up higher. There's something you're going to see in your binoculars. Very, they zoom across in front of you. They're much more robust flyers. They are better at flying than damselflies based on the structure of their hind wings. And they, let's see, so they are, when they perch with their wings out in a horizontal fashion, generally, sometimes down even more than 180 degrees, once in a while up a little bit, but they don't fold their wings over their backs. And that's what damselflies do. And dragonflies love to eat damselflies. Dragonflies belong to a suborder within the odonates called Anisoptera, and that means not the same wing, because their hind wings are differently shaped than their forewings. And damselflies belong to the suborder Zygoptera, and they kind of have the same shape of forewings and hind wings, so they are weaker flyers.
So, Marlo, where do jewel wings fit in?
Jewel wings are damselflies. They belong to a family of damselflies called the jewel wings or Coloptorhynchidae. And so there are, in Wisconsin, there are three or four species of jewel wings. There's the ebony jewel wing, which is gorgeous, the river jewel wing, and there's the smoky ruby spot and the American ruby spot. So they've got wonderful names. In fact, the common names for dragonflies and damselflies beat all.
Yeah, they do. They are. They're spectacular.
Very good. So you were just talking about their flying apparatus. It would be fun, I think, to hear a little bit more about what allows dragonflies, and I don't know to what extent this is true of damselflies as well, but this ability that they have, which I assume is pretty much unique in the insect world, in terms of the different kinds of flying that they can do. And what is it exactly about the way their wings are structured that allows them this astonishing versatility as flyers?
So besides each having individual muscles attached that they can control separately, the wings themselves have a high degree of venation. They have wing veins that create, they have longitudinal veins and cross veins that create tremendous numbers of cells. So if you think of a leaf on a tree, for example, you know the veins moving out. They have something very similar to that, but then they have all these cross connecting veins. And so when you look at a dragonfly at first glance, you think those wings are very flat. But when you look up close, they are not. And so you can get all sorts of airfoils or, I don't know all the physics terms, vortex streaks or whatever underneath that provide all sorts of lift when they take off. And they can angle their wings slightly like you would the ailerons on an airplane. And that can create more lift or depress them to bring them down and so forth. So they really manipulate the wings, and they have a venation pattern on their wings that that allows them different types of flight. In fact, that wing venation pattern changes between families. So if you look at, a lot of skimmers are perchers. They perch a lot through the day. And you compare that to a cruiser, that name just tells you what they do. They're in flight all day long. And they fly down the banks of rivers, and they're impossible to catch. I hate cruisers. I never catch one in my net. But that has to do in part because of the wing venation pattern. And so that's a big thing. Their hind wings at the base are widened. And they do use those a lot as ailerons. They also have at the leading edge of their wings, they have about two-thirds of the way out from the base, something called a pterostigma or stigma, and it's a pigmented cell. And it acts, they think, as a counterweight, so they get a little flexibility at the tip of their wings as well to alter the flow of air in and around the wings. And then they have some cross veins, something called the notus, and that cross vein also is about a third of the way out in the wing, and that allows them some flexibility. So if you put that all together, I mean, they were used as models for early aircrafts and for building airplanes. They're still using them for flights on drones and for drone flights and everything. It's incredible.
Wow.
They have tiny little spicules coming off of those veins that they are now modeling in microbiology for antimicrobial surfaces because they poke holes in bacterial cell walls.
Wow.
There's nothing that isn't cool.
So Marla, are you saying, for example, when we see the species of dragonflies that have spots on their wings, if you will, those spots actually influence flight patterns and flight capabilities? It's not just for, I don't know, show or something. It actually is very functional.
That's a great question. Actually, Nan, if you're talking about the dark cell and the darkened cross veins, yes, that's true. But if mm-hmm. you're talking about the pigment on wings, mm-hmm. that's a different story. It's kind of interesting because pigment on wings is, we think, for show. And it's for reproductive show. So males, like you look at the 12-spot skimmer. Wow, that's like a disco strobe light when they are flapping their wings. And you've got all that white, blue, and black strobe effect. We think that is largely due to for attracting females or for displays showing which species, identifying to species when you're looking for a mate. Some of the pigment may have something to do with cooling, actually. The dragonfly can get too hot. It's a cold-blooded animal. It needs the sun to warm up its wing muscles so it can fly. But there are, when it gets above 90, 95 degrees, they get hot like us. So they stick their abdomens up directly in the air. It's called obelisking, so that the back of the abdomen does not pick up the sun rays and they can cool down. But also maybe some of the coloration we see on the wings can aid in either heating or cooling the dragonfly.
Speaking of coloration, I wanted to ask you, what color are dragonflies, generally speaking, if it's even possible to talk, generally speaking, about the color of dragonflies? And I ask that in part because it seems like the color of a given dragonfly might even change depending on how you're seeing it or where it is sitting.
It totally does. Totally does. That is very observant. Nan was talking about the jewel wings a few seconds ago, and actually jewel wings have the most gorgeous metallic bodies. And that blue, the color blue in dragonflies is structural, like a butterfly's wings. It is a structural color that can reflect light at different angles. And when a jewel wing moves its body, sometimes you see it and it looks bright blue, and other times it looks green. So it can actually change its color in that regard. But also, there is an entomologist I know. He's out at Denison University out east. His name's Tom Schultz, and he studies the pigment in dragonflies. And some pigment is actual pigment. others is structural, and some is based on combinations of those. And what we know is that the yellow color is in dragonflies is pigment, but that nice blue color that Nan was talking about goes away when you collect dragonflies. So one great thing about dragonflies is people don't collect dragonflies very often because the beautiful jewel-like colors in their eyes, which are so structural, disappear when they die. And the color of their bodies oftentimes disappears when they die, and people want colorful collections. So that's nice for the dragonfly. but there's a group of damselflies we call the dancers. Or the genus Argia. And many of them change colors, Greg, when they mate. And the male, who's oftentimes bright blue, when he hooks up with a female, all of a sudden he goes dark gray. And he changes his color because when they mate, they're in tandem, they hang together, and he does that mate guarding with her while she lays her eggs. And so he's standing straight up, grabbed her by her neck, and he just looks like he's they call it sentinel position. He just looks like a guard, but he doesn't want to be seen because he's sitting up there really fresh for the picking from any bird or other dragonfly. And so he kind of goes cryptic on her. And so that's where the structural nanoparticles that allow for the blue coloration, they actually migrate down deeper away from the cuticle when he hooks on and he mates. This also happens in the evening when they cool down, they get darker. And all dragonflies, when they first emerge, have really light color. In the next coming hours to days, they darken up and they really flush out into bright, bright, brilliant colors. They can be any color that you can imagine on our visible spectrum for our eye. There are gorgeous hot pink, neon pink dragonflies I have photographed in Southeast Asia. They knock your socks off. Hmm. You know, they look like they ought to be a neon sign outside a tavern. But then there are beautiful shades of purple, blues, greens, yellows, reds, you name it, there's everything. And some dragonflies, they go through a color change as they age. A lot of female damselflies do this. They get what we call prunescent. They turn gray like me as they age. And so
I think I win that contest.
Only because of Clara, my dear.
So one of the things that is, of course, a really important thing for us to say about dragonflies is that they're our friends. That they're the good guys or good gals or whatever, but I mean, because they are predators that tend to eat a lot of pests. First of all, is that pretty much exclusively what they eat, insects that we think of as pests, or is their diet more ranging than that, and do they occasionally eat things we would just assume they didn't?
They are true generalists. So they will eat anything that is moving that they can grab a hold of. As nymphs, dragonflies will latch onto tadpoles, and as they're metamorphosing, they've been known to chew down one of the legs. A lot of three-legged frogs from a certain pond in the United States shook people up for a while before they realized it was dragonfly nymphs that were causing it and not some industrial pollutant. Mm. they'll take snails out of shells as nymphs and so forth. They'll eat minnows. Anything that they can grab with their amazing lower jaw. As adults, they will take anything out of the air flying. They've been known, there are a couple of pictures on the web of large dragonflies taking down hummingbirds, if you can imagine.
Oh, boy.
There are a couple of species in the rainforest that are very specific, and they fly into spider webs and take spiders out of webs. Other than that, they are primarily generalists. However, they like flying insects, although they will glean them off of plant leaves. If they see an insect, mostly they take them out of the air. And they have remarkable neurology so that they can visually assess where a prey item is flying, how far in front of it is, where its velocity, where it's flying to, what vector it's flying at, and they can zoom right in and just pick it out of the air. They can hold it in their spiky legs, which are positioned up under their voracious jaws, and then they can just mow while they're on the wing. So they're pretty much generalists. However, they have never been shown to be a pest themselves. They are absolutely something we need and want to take out the more pestilential flying insects in Wisconsin.
Right. Do I remember correctly that they are rather territorial, and some of what you're describing in terms of their behavior, does that stem from that quality of being territorial?
Yeah, there are a number of dragonflies that are extremely territorial and aggressive towards each other or anything that comes into their territory when they are guarding it over the water. And those are males. So many male dragonflies will set up a zone over a wetland or an aquatic habitat, and then they keep an eye on that. And so, however, there are some males that find their way around. We think of the omega. If you think of an alpha and omega and a wolf pack, the omega always finds a way. And same thing can happen in dragonflies. You can have males that can't set up a territory over a water, which is prime ovipositioning habitat. And so that male, he's ousted by the other males that have their territory. So he may find ways of when the female's ovipositing to sneak in and grab her, or to go up to where she's feeding in the zone away from the water and pick her up there. So, you know, he just goes to another area to try and get her where he's not going to have to engage in aggressive territorial disputes over the water.
Wow. So we need dragonflies. We want dragonflies. How are dragonflies doing, and particularly here in the upper Midwest and especially here in Wisconsin?
I think in Wisconsin, dragonflies are doing very well. We have a lot of wonderful species. The data that has been collected by the volunteer monitors with the Wisconsin Dragonfly Society has found in the last 8 years, they've found new species that we didn't know were here. They are monitoring species that appear to potentially just be migrants or possibly vagrants on weather systems that have come in. We're finding that Wisconsin has a nice diverse group of dragons and damsels. In other areas, if you look at Hawaii has a number of endangered dragonflies and damselflies. In fact, almost all of one group of dragonflies and damselflies that they have, or of damselflies that they used to have on the Hawaiian Islands, of that group, many are almost completely gone. That is all due to loss of critical habitat. Usually we don't worry too much about chemical pollutants with dragonflies and damselflies, but it's the physical quality of the waterways in which they depend for their larval or nymphal development that makes a difference. And because of massive development everywhere in the United States, those physical properties of waters and the watersheds have been changed drastically. So what we see isn't that we decrease the population of dragonflies and damselflies, we decrease the diversity of species, and that's a shame. So there's about 12 or so species I call the Dirty Dozen in Chicagoland, and they show up in every retention pond. So when a developer says, don't worry about us draining this wetland, we're going to rebuild it, you can't rebuild a natural wetland. You just can't. And so what comes back are those Dirty Dozen. And because we see them flying in spades around us, we think everything's rosy and well. And in truth, it isn't. We've destroyed the critical habitat of some native species, and they are continuing to diminish.
Right. So what we ideally would have is a wide range of dragonflies and damselflies, and that diversity tends to diminish when we do bad things to their habitat.
Precisely.
Wow. So what is it that that private citizens can do if they want to be allies of the dragonfly?
I think that, first of all, is recognize them. I think that if you never know something's there, you don't care when it's gone. And so I think that the first thing that we would like people to do is get out and look at them, realize that they are not dangerous. They are lovely. When you, the first dragonfly you ever take out of an insect net, is an experience you never forget. When you see those jeweled eyes looking up at you and that sentient being. So I think actually getting out and searching for them, photographing them is such a wonderful way to develop the appreciation. So the appreciation has to come first. And once you start to appreciate any group of living organisms, you can't get enough of it. So it gets you out, it allows you physical activity. Dragonflies fly when it's sunny out. It's between 70 and 90 degrees, perfect temperature. You know, it's when you want to be outside. It gets you physically active. It gets your mind reeling from the beauty of it. And then you can get involved with the Wisconsin Dragonfly Society. They have meetings, once an annual meeting every year. Go and join the folk that put all that together. I don't think there's any better people on earth than dragonfly people. They are so welcoming. They are an inclusive society. They work with the urban outdoor projects in Milwaukee. So they connect with teachers and educators, and they love having everybody in the field. And so go out there, join us, and let us take you out and show you some of the more spectacular dragonflies on the planet. And then you can start monitoring in your backyard. Who was it? Agassiz, I think, that said in the late 1700s, he said, I went traveling this summer and I got as far as halfway across my backyard. So I think spend the summer traveling in your backyard, and then start building little ponds and getting involved in all the local organizations, and that's how you can help.
Very good. A quick closing thought, Nan?
Well, I just want to echo Marla's sentiments. Dragonflies need something to eat, and they're generalists, which means that they eat a lot of different things. And insects depend on good quality native habitats in order to thrive and survive. So one of the best things that you can do is have native habitat in your yard somewhere or somewhere in your community, so that everybody has something to eat and everyone has somewhere to hide from predators, and everyone has a place to be on stage, if you will, for things to see. I was just thinking too that, you know, butterflies, dragonflies, and damselflies are a really great way to introduce people of all ages to insects. You hear people say, I hate insects, they're ugly, they're frightening, but it's true. The first time you get to see a beautiful dragonfly or a damselfly up close, you just can't believe what you're holding. You can't believe the colors that you see, and then you just want to see it again and again and again. So they really are great ambassadors to the rest of the living world.
Very nicely put. Nan Calvert, with her monthly visit to the program, and our very special guest today, Marla Garrison, biology instructor at McHenry County College in Crystal Lake, Illinois. Marla Garrison, we are so thankful to you for making time in your schedule to join us once again to talk about these amazing creatures, the dragonfly and the damselfly. Thank you so much for being part of the morning show, and very best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure. And I hope everybody with children, instead of sitting in front of a computer learning this fall, takes them outside with a net. I think that's the best education they can have. Thank you both again, Nan and Greg.
Glad to have you.
Thanks, Marla.
This weekend, we have a couple of interesting morning shows being offered up in the podcast version of the program.
Tomorrow in particular, for longtime fans of the morning show and of Saturday Night Bandstand, a conversation I recorded back in the late 1990s with Sam Chell on the occasion of a big concert at Carthage to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the birthday of George Gershwin. So this is Sam Chell talking about the great George Gershwin and his long and amazing career. So that conversation from, I believe, 1997 will be the Saturday Morning Show podcast.